It's a beautiful day in Tampa Bay for a Throwback Thursday, February 14th, 2019, the only Valentine's Day 2019 in the history of humanity. Let us continue to choose.
On purpose.
With a purpose.
To give.
A great VD day. How are you, Big O?
I'm doing amazing, Glenn. How are you?
I have no complaints, but thank you for caring enough to ask. And I know you are always a caring man, but especially on this Valentine's Day. And you know another reason it's a beautiful day in Tampa Bay, Big O?
No.
Because on this Valentine's Day, we get to speak about love and a tremendous manifestation of love, peace, with Stephen Hecht. Greetings, you beautiful humans. This is Glenn Klein Online. Welcome in to another excursion into organized fun with a purpose. Yes, the podcast that covers it all. All bases. And I have a very large first baseman to my immediate right. You know him, you love him, you can't live without him. The producer and engineer extraordinaire, Theodore Owen Pratt. Owen!
I wanted to make a baseball joke to what you were saying, but I just don't know enough about baseball to even be able to make a joke about that.
We just had...
Just doing what first basemen do over
the
here.
The future Hall of Famer broadcaster, Dwayne Statz, online the other day. I talked baseball and life with him for an hour plus. He seemed plugged in.
I was pretty plugged in. It was a very magnetic personality, drew me in.
When's the last baseball game you went to?
When I was like eight. Roger Dean Stadium, the local, what do they call it, club team, double A, minor league.
Minor league team.
That's the one.
The man is from the Miami, Florida area. You never went and saw the Florida and then Miami Marlins?
Nope.
You and most of Miami did not go to that. But he's ready to rock and roll. He is a 25-year-old. He is single, ladies, and easy on the eyes. Let's just put it that way. And not just a pretty face.
And difficult on the hearts.
Ooh.
Like that one?
I don't think it's true, though. Your problem is they always fall in love with you right away.
It's a difficult problem to have, everybody.
your generation is really an interesting group of beautiful humans. That's for sure.
What do you think our most interesting features are?
I think that there is a wide disparity between those who are just trying to have their personal needs met. And then there is the other segment of your culture that really doesn't care about making money, being professional. In fact, billionaires are often castigated as evil. People that are rich, and there's a fairly decent percentage of people that want equal rights for everybody. This is your generation, absolutely influenced the transgender movement without a doubt. You see the kids at Parkland, the kids that suffered the horrific shooting in Parkland, Florida. They caused some major movement in this country on gun laws. Even in Florida here. I mean, Governor Scott of Florida actually did some stuff. And I'm not saying good, bad, or indifferent, but they absolutely were movers and shakers. You got Congresswoman Cortez now from New York. She's only 29. She's making a huge difference. But there are people older than you that do care about the earth and issues of war and peace and are socially and politically active, and we have one of them online with us today. This is an old friend of the radio program. His name is Stephen Hecht. He is the co-founder and chief executive peacemaker of Million Peacemakers. Stephen brings over 30 years of personal and business experience to the field of conflict resolution and is the co-author of the bestseller Nonflict, The Art of Everyday Peacemaking. Million Peacemakers is a nonprofit which empowers people to transform conflict to non-flict. See what he did there with the word? Over 145,000 people around the world were trained in the first 4 years with a focus on families, youth, and businesses. Stephen Heck has an MBA from Ivy Business School, Western University, Canada, and a BCom from McGill. He's married to Naomi. Stephen has 4 kids, 3 stepchildren, and a daughter-in-law. And we just learned 2 dogs. So please welcome from north of the border, Mr. Stephen Heck. Stephen.
Hey, Glenn.
How are you?
Awesome, thanks. How are you?
I have no complaints, Stephen, but thank you for caring enough to ask. Stephen is an old friend of the old radio show in Wisconsin, the On the Air, as opposed to the On the Line now. And your mic doesn't sound seem like it's on Big O.
Yeah, we spoke actually 9 times, you on your old radio show.
How do you know that?
Counting.
How do you know that?
Because I kept track.
You keep track of all the things that you do?
I have a calendar, and when I have an appointment, I do enter it into the calendar, and I do keep track. Yeah.
Oh, so it's in the like a computerized calendar, so it's, yeah, it's easily accessible. Yeah. Yeah, you were definitely one of the members of the power rotation, and hopefully you will be again. But this is a much better format for me in so many ways. And when I was let go from this that station, after making just asking a question, I was doing a segment on race every week. You know how we're supposed to be talking about race relations, right, Steve? And they always say, we need to have a conversation about race relations. Yep. Well, I chose to have a conversation about race relations on a radio station in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin area that is ranked 2nd worst city in the United States of America, the 2nd worst city for African Americans. And Racine, where the actual studio was 3. So it's kind of an important topic. The station was doing nothing with it. I met a gentleman, local civil rights leader, former school superintendent, Milton Thompson, who wrote a book called The Only One in the Room, because he was always the only black guy in the room with all the school superintendents in Wisconsin. A lifetime of observation on race, and we built a really great rapport. He came on the show, Stephen, like you did the first time, just, you know, hawking his book and with his cause, et cetera, et cetera. And so then we, as you and I have, we built a rapport. And I asked him a question about hockey and African-Americans. I said, why don't African-Americans dominate in hockey the way they do in other team sports since Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball? And he answered it beautifully. I knew the answer. It was an economic issue. And he said that the economy starting to equal out in his community, if you will, that things would eventually equal out. And of course, we're seeing that right now. You're in Canada. Almost every NHL team has a player of color on their team now. It's so cool. And so, and then we went on to talk about whatever else we were talking about. And then when I came back from vacation, my boss called me into his conference room. And he asked me if I had asked Milt that question. And I said, I did. And he said, well, we had a complaint from another civil rights group, and because of that, you can't be on the radio anymore. And I said, Dave, I said, did you hear it? He said, no. I said, you're going strictly on what they said. He said, yes. I said, do you want to hear it? It's on my computer in the office. He said, nope, decision's been made. I said, why don't we have the guy who complained on the show with Mill to talk about it? Nope, decision's been made. So the station was struggling financially, and they were looking to cut costs. They had set up 2 girls in the office to be fired a couple weeks before that. But I was up in Wisconsin only to do the show. I can do what I'm doing the rest of my life with the coaching and my writing anywhere. So I decided when I got back, I was really upset about it, Stephen. And I decided when I got back, I was going to do this podcast. And I thought to myself, as upset as I was then, I said, there'll be a time where I'll be happy they did that to me. And we're here at that time right now. So we will have Stephen on many times to talk about this most urgent issue. How many million peacemakers do you have so far?
We don't have any billion yet, but we're going to get there soon. We have 145,000 roughly that we've trained directly, but they have impacted millions.
I think I was like number 37.
You were one of the earlier ones. Yeah, you could impact many others.
I'm a million peacemaker. How do you describe a person not only that's a member of your group, but somebody that is a peacemaker by nature or by choice?
Well, first they would live it themselves, create inner peace. Then they would practice it in their families. And then once they're comfortable enough, they would then share it with others outside of their families and potentially in their communities. But to me, you're a peacemaker after you learn the skills and you just apply it with, you know, in your own life.
And that's one of the things, I mean, maybe one of the most important things about Nonflict, your book, is that it gives you the skills to become a peacemaker.
Yes. And the goal is that everyone could be a peacemaker. So no matter what you do, you could be a fireman, an engineer, a sanitation engineer, garbage man, a radio host, and a peacemaker. So you meet someone at a bar. What do? Well, I'm an engineer and I'm a peacemaker. Hmm. And we registered billion the same day as million. So when we do get to a million, we're going to have a party and change our name.
I would like to be at that party. With the million,
you're invited.
With the million peacemaker, you call it Nonflict, not conflict. Nonflict. You made up a word. Please define Nonflict to the beautiful humans.
Well, there was no word for a resolved conflict that we could find, and we were looking for an out of the box solution to resolve conflicts and also to call it. And in one of our brainstorming sessions, my stepson Gregory actually came up with that word, and we loved it. I like short words that make you think a little bit. So Nonflict is a three-step process to resolve any conflict. It's to understand ourselves and the other. And when we do, we realize that there's commonality between us because we all want the same thing, pretty much. We all want to feel respected, and feeling disrespected, if you think about it, is the source of 90% or more of conflicts out there. We all want to feel safe, understood, loved. So step one is to take the time to understand ourselves and the other. We ask ourselves, what are our facts and feelings around the conflict? What's important to us? We would mirror the essence of what the other person said. And then we would look at what's our shared reality and what's the real underlying conflict. The key to any conflict is to understand, or any problem, what's the real problem versus what are the symptoms of the problem. We look at what's working well for us, because often when we're in conflict, we're only thinking about the negative, the fact that we're going to step back and see what can we appreciate about the other person, even if it's just that we're willing to talk to each other. Then we look at what's our worst case scenario and how would that feel if we can't resolve it, because people need a real or perceived crisis to take action toward change. Then step three of the Nonflict way is to co-create, where we visualize our ideal reality and how that would feel. So if we're in a family, the ideal reality is with my spouse that he or she doesn't try to change me. She or she would bring out the best in me, allow me the freedom to be my best self, my true self. Then we look at what are the obstacles to achieve that ideal reality. And then of the obstacle that we could control or influence, what could we do to overcome them? Followed by an action plan, who's going to do what, when. And those are the steps and questions of the Nonflict way, which are simple enough to fit on the back of a business card.
How successful have you been in making Nonflict a word that would be in the everyday vernacular or vocabulary?
We're working on that. We have a trademark on the word. We have the book, as you know, Nonflict. It's now in Spanish. It's in Hebrew, in Marathi, where we're very active in India with women's groups, over 100,000 women, and college students. And I'm about to present it to a conference on religion and the UN Sustainable Development Goals at the Vatican, which will be attended by about 300 world leaders in religions and people that are of international organizations. That'll be in March. I'll be meeting the Pope as well, and we'll be introducing Nonflict to them as well, and the world media will be there. So I think after March, there'll be quite a bit more people that are familiar with Nonflict.
Amen. And Stephen has been in workshops, check this, last 12 months in Honduras, Nicaragua, El Salvador, the good old United States of America, Puerto Rico, Japan, Thailand, the Philippines, Israel, Jordan, Mexico, Bulgaria, England, Germany, Spain, and oh, Canada, where he hails from. Where are you this morning?
Right now, I'm north of Montreal, about an hour and a quarter north at our cottage. It's really beautiful here. There's a lake and mountains, a lot of snow out my window. So that's where I am right now with my two dogs.
That sounds very peaceful.
It is.
Ironically. So what Nonflict, obviously, that's great that you trademarked it. Do you have a Wikipedia page for Nonflict?
No, not yet. We have to get it on our to-do list.
Yeah,
we actually tried too early on, and it got turned down for some reason, and we'll try again soon.
I mean, they have, like, you can look up on Wikipedia, like, a word and the origin of the word. And, yeah, let's get it going. You know me, I love branding and I love creative ideas and Nonflict, the opposite of conflict. There's Nonflict.
Yeah. And by the way, we need conflict. I'm not against conflict. Conflict is good. We need conflict to grow, to innovate. And conflict is just two or more different perspectives coming into contact with each other. So by definition, conflict is neither positive or negative, but how we deal with it is either constructive or destructive. And because most of us don't have the tools to deal with it constructively, it's usually destructive. So that's the purpose.
I was just having a conversation actually with a friend who is she teaches, you can't call it meditation in schools, but she teaches mindfulness, and she goes into schools and she'll, you know, have these sessions with kids and just have mindfulness teachings. And, there's a lot of studies out now that show how impactful it is. And it could be, we're seeing this movement towards more holistic approaches to education, and it seems like a really powerful your approach to conflict seems like a really powerful way to just frame the whole conflict resolution approach in a really effective way, and I'd be interested to see what kind of effect that might have in a school setting. Have you ever looked into anything like that?
Mm-hmm. So when the book was launched, I was interviewed by our Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. It's a national radio station. And I got a call by a doctor in a small town in British Columbia, our most westernmost province. And she said, we've got about 3,000 people in our town, and it's about half Indigenous, Nuhawk Nation, it's called, about half white people, and there's a lot of conflict going on. Would you be willing to come share it with our high school? And on the reserve, off the reserve, and with our community leaders. And I agreed to do that because I felt quite ignorant about our Indigenous people, the First Nations of our country, and I wanted to see how it might work with them. And by that time, I'd already done it with Palestinian activist women and, you know, with tough conflicts. But I wanted to see it in a high school setting. And I had done it with high school kids initially, kids 15 and over or 14 and over when we did it across Canada with a business group. So I went there and I had dinner the night before with my host, and her daughter was in grade 9. And the word empathy came up over dinner, and the daughter said, don't use that word. The kids won't understand it. So these were the bottom two high schools in performance in the province of British Columbia, out of thousands of high schools. And about 9 out of 10 of these girls had been sexually abused by the age of 16. Most families, if not everyone, had drug or alcohol abuse exposure. And the morning before, I was about to meet the high school kids on the reserve. I was meeting with the teachers, and they were having a debate on whether or not to put the goalposts up that had been taken down because it was the 1 year anniversary of where a girl committed suicide from the goalposts. Oh, yeah. They had taken them down. So this was serious stuff going on there. And I was warned.
This was your first foray into schools?
Yes.
Wow. You really hit the ground running. Holy moly.
Yes. Yeah. And the girl warned me, the high school girl in grade 9 warned me that two of her classmates are suicidal. So, and I hadn't dealt with that before either. So I was a little concerned, but I did the workshop the way we do, which is very experiential, very interactive. And at the end of the workshop, one of those girls came up to me in tears and saying, "Thank you so much. You had no idea how much I needed that." And that's what made it all worthwhile. That was one of the suicidal girls. Wow. And just the fact that she was felt listened to in a safe environment and able to deal with her conflict, which was serious at home, with someone who she never would have shared it with earlier, really helped her. So that was my first exposure to high schools, and we've had others. And actually, I tried it. One of our targets is families, and I tried it this summer with one of our team members has an 8-year-old daughter, and we did it with their family, and it was amazingly effective.
How is working with young people different than working with adults?
They're very, very intuitively positive on this approach. They feel they need to be listened to as much as adults do. And often adults just tell them what to do without listening to their point of view. And it was so empowering for them to actually have the adult or the other kid have to listen to them, which is a part of our process when we go through sharing what the conflict is and how they feel about it. They loved it. So it was very cool. All we did for the 8-year-old is we broke it up into three sessions of an hour each rather than one 4-hour session, which we can do with an older person. It was cute at the end of it. At the beginning of the session with the 8-year-old, her mother had been with an iPad and taking notes on it, and their daughter wanted to play with it or to use it. And the mother said no and took it away from her without giving her any reason. At the end of the session, during our session, we do role playing where we put ourselves in the other person's shoes. The daughter said, "Mommy, you play me for a minute." And she took the iPad, and the mother said, "Give it back." She said, "No, you can't have it." "How does it feel, Mommy?"
This was an 8-year-old?
An 8-year-old.
Jesus.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I had done it in Mexico, where we invited 14-year-olds, but one of the families couldn't find a babysitter for their 9-year-old. And so the daughter attended it in the session as well. And at the end of the session, she came up with her 14-year-old daughter, older sister, I mean, and she gave me a hug and said, "Thank you." And she said, "Can I talk to you alone?" And she pushed her sister away. And she said, "What do I do with, I have two conflicts. I have a friend of mine who isn't including me anymore in the group, and I'm really sad and feeling left out." And then she talked about a bully in school as well, how to deal with that. So these kids are exposed to conflict, and our approach, although initially it was geared toward an older crowd, it works. They take right to it too, as well.
He is the winner of the Canada Award for Business Excellence and the YMCA Peace Medal. He is Stephen Hecht, speaking to us from Quebec, Canada. So are you working besides in your role as Chief Executive Peacemaker? Do you have an outside gig as well?
No, this is it. I do some volunteer work related to what I'm doing for this group called YPO. So I'm the incoming vice chair of the Peace Action Network. I'm organizing an event on innovation for the group, an international event and organization that will be at Waterloo, Ontario. But that's not a paying gig. So my full-time volunteer gig actually is Chief Executive Peacemaker. I haven't taken anything from it either.
So you were kind of well-off, high energy businessman until you got into this, correct?
I had 30 years in business, yes, before doing this.
Now, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, Stephen, that we've spoken not only 9 times on the old radio station, but also many times off the air, I have a sense of you like even more downplaying sort of even your tonality, your vocal quality. You're very pastoral in your approach, even more than you were a couple of years ago. Is it, how much on purpose is that?
I don't give any thought to it. So it's whatever is coming out, is coming out.
You sound at peace.
Well, I do have a lot more inner peace than I used to. That's for sure. I lived many years with conflict in my personal life. I don't know if I mentioned I'm married 27 years to 3 wives. So I'm married
all at once.
Third time. No.
I thought you were Jewish, not Mormon, Stephen.
That's correct. I'm married 9 years, 3 times now, and I'm very happily married to Naomi now for the past 9 years, and we celebrate our 10th anniversary in July. So I think that helps, having a peaceful, supportive partner, in my case, wife, who is enabling me, empowering me to do this. So I think that's really helpful, and being at peace with my kids and my extended family, my parents and siblings, has really helped as well.
Ironically, or maybe not coincidentally, Owen and I met volunteering for another organization called the Gospel Revolution, which basically is a recovering program for Christians who are spiritually abused during their years in that religion. And what we discovered was that the ancient text, the Torah, what Christianity calls the Old Testament, and what Jewish people call the scriptures, and what the New Testament characters call the scriptures, actually talks about that all people are perfect and righteous already, no matter what they do. And what we discovered was the meditation of that, the discussion of that, the affirmation of that, the ongoing study of that, it's really fascinating, produces peace in where we need it, which is between our ears. When a person knows that they're already good to go, they're already righteous, they're already one with God, if you will, and one with everybody else by virtue of the understanding and the translation and the interpretation.
And that their enemies are too.
Yes, that the worst people that have ever walked the face of the earth are as perfect as God is. This is the understanding. Now, the ironic thing is that basically Christianity teaches 180 degrees difference, that most people are going to a place of everlasting punishment that, by the way, is not in the Bible. It was misinterpreted, mistranslated by originally the Roman Catholic Church, and then it became a great hand-me-down to the Protestant religion. And yes, all people, regardless of behavior, faith, lack of faith, atheism, what sexual orientation, whatever, the revelation, the understanding that we have is that everybody's good to go. Out of that comes peace like a river, joy unspeakable and full of glory is one way it's described. And when a person has a basis of that, Stephen, that they know that this person that they're in conflict with, or that they are doing heinous things or saying heinous things about them and about their family, about their country, about their religion, if you will, that they're just as perfect as everybody else, that lowers the temperature immediately. And how do you get people who don't have the understanding that I just articulated, that Owen and I share, to get to a place where they can look across the table if they're Israeli at a Palestinian, or vice versa, if you're a Palestinian, and feel completely put upon, downtrodden, misused by the Israeli people or the Israeli government, to say, okay, let's come together, when they don't see themselves as perfect and righteous and equal in the eyes of God?
I love it. Great question. And I wanted to experiment with that very question before I started Million Peacemakers. before I had the idea to start Million Peacemakers. So we had already done the workshop, the non-conflict workshop across Canada with about 700 people. And my idea was to do it a year later with our Palestine and Israel chapter of this Young Present Organization group. But 3 days before that, I went to the Kalundia refugee camp outside of Jerusalem on the other side of the wall. And I went with my wife and stepson to the camp to meet with these activist, Palestinian activist women. And I'm a Jewish Canadian. And the founder, 84-year-old, her bio says, born in Jaffa, an ethnically cleansed city. She had a picture of her and Arafat and her and our bus and her and a bus in her office.
That's a hell of a place to start right there.
Yeah. Right. So I wanted to test out non-conflict on a tough audience. So I went and I was in a room around with 15 of these women, and the founder looked at me in the eye, and her first question to me is, "You're from Canada. Your Prime Minister Harper did not accept us as a state in the United Nations. What do the Palestinians do against Canadians?" So my answer to her was, "That's true, our Prime Minister did that, but I'm not a politician, I'm a business person that travels around the world, and all that I and the people I meet know about you is what we hear about in the media. Would you be willing to share your true stories I could then share when I travel?" And she said, "Okay." We ran around the table, all through a translator, where they shared their stories. I took them through the questions of non-conflict. And all I did was mirror them. I didn't agree with anything. All I did was listen to them and make sure that I understood them correctly so they felt respected and understood. At the end of 4 hours, which included a nice Magluba lunch, the founder came and hugged my wife and looked at me in the eye again and said, "Thank you for being a friend to the Palestinians. We'd like what we learned. We're going to use with our husbands. But more importantly, we're prepared to meet 15 Jewish Israeli women. And if you could get Obama, Netanyahu, and a bus in a room, teach them the same thing, we mothers won't let them out till there's a deal."
Wow.
So that's when I realized that I had in my hand a gift to the world that I needed to share. And that's why I decided to leave my career in real estate development to do this full time, starting Million Peacemakers.
Well, it sounds like you've been really effective with this technique and ability to share it with people. How did you come across this and develop it?
The process itself was created by Dr. Amir Kafir from Israel, who had worked with our Peace Action Network within that business group, YPO, where they brought together Israelis and Arabs, Greeks and Turks, Turks and Armenians, Indians and Pakistanis. So the process had been tested on those groups before then. And we just created a workshop that would allow people to really experience it with their own conflicts. So it came and we adopted it and changed it and improved it actually every time. So it's an ongoing process.
It's such an optimistic, positive thing to do with one's life, you know, help manifest the peace that actually we think actually exists in every human heart. It just needs to go up the elevator to the brain, if you will. Mm-hmm. And our whole reason for being, our whole raison d'etre, a little French there for you, Steve, is to allow people to understand who they truly are. The reason that people misbehave, whether that it be just between a friend or a loved one or mistreat themselves, or certainly when you start getting into assault and rape and genocide, is because they hate themselves. They don't know who they truly are. All this stuff is just self-loathing projected onto other people. And when you are approaching, let's say, the Palestinians or whomever that you're dealing with, and you are starting to talk to them in a respectful, listening way and hearing their stories, you're telling them, "I really want to know who you really are. Not what the media says, not what my religion says, not what my neighbor down the street says. I want to know you." And that starts tapping in to that real identity, doesn't it?
It sure does. It's so effective when you take the time to listen to people. I did this exercise. We do an active listening exercise, and we describe active listening where you make eye contact, because eyes are the windows to the soul. You are in an environment where you can hear them without the interruption of your phone going off or beeping or other noises. You have an open mind, because often we have a closed mind when we have conflict with someone, and having an open heart to the person where you can have empathy for the other person's feelings. And the key is you don't have to agree with them, just to listen to them actively. And then you would mirror back the essence of what they said and ask to understand you well, because we have our filters. So we did that exercise. We do that in our workshop, where we share an event or person that had a major impact in our life and why. And they would share it. And I did this with this group of students from the Middle East who I work with. They come to McGill to do their master's of social work for 1 year here in Montreal. And then they go back to one of 11 community centers we have called the International Community Action Network Program at McGill. So I did this exercise with these students who were right off of the plane from, they were Israelis, Palestinians, Jordanian, and Syrian. And when we went around the table initially introducing each other, we had a gentleman named Amit. Hi, my name is Amit Kitain, and I am a Jewish Israeli Zionist. And we had Adnan. My name is Adnan Malmahaymid, and I am a Muslim Syrian. And all I know about Jewish Israelis is that you are the enemy. You are not to be trusted. You are violent. You are this and that. The other Palestinians chimed in and say, yes, you know, and to us, a Zionist is like, you know, the worst thing in the world. You took our land. You kicked us out. You kicked out my grandmother, you know, blah, blah, blah. So there was conflict. So I partnered the Amit and Adnan, the Israeli and the Syrian, to do this exercise on active listening. And I watched the two of them from about 2 feet away. So Amit shared, well, an event or person had a major impact in my life, would be my brother, Tom. He was my older brother. He was 5 years older. He was my hero, my only sibling. And I loved him with all my heart. And when I was 13, he was 18. He had to go to the army, like every Israeli. And one day we got a knock on our door, and we're told that Tom is dead. He got killed in a helicopter crash over Lebanon with 75 other Israelis in an accident. Really? And the pain that I felt, I would not want on my worst enemy. I still feel it every day. And you could tell Adnan was impacted by it, and he mirrored it back well. And then Adnan shared, well, I was living in Dara, where the nonviolent revolution against Assad started. And kids were arrested for doing graffiti, and they were being tortured in the jail. And we were having protests in the street to release the kids. And my older brother, who was my hero, he was a doctor. And the Assad forces started shooting into the crowd. And my brother was tending to a wounded person. And I saw him shot in the head in front of me. And the pain that I felt, I would not want on my worst enemy, and that I still feel every day. And the two of them broke out into tears and hugs, and they became brothers.
Wow.
To this day, they became closer than anyone else in that group. And 3 minutes earlier, they were enemies. So to your point, when you just listen to the other, to their story, and mirror it back without judgment, just listening and showing that you are paying attention, you find the humanity and the commonality that we all share.
There's no doubt about it. And really, beautiful humans, when you're listening and empathizing with the other person, you're really listening to yourself, because we are one. I know it doesn't seem like it, but Stephen Hecht and Owen Pratt and Glenn Klein, and hopefully you, we're swimming with the tide of history. We're not swimming against the tide. The tide is going positive. The people that are trying to continue in a world of conflict, they're the ones swimming against the tide. I know it doesn't seem that way because of the way the media reports things. Stephen Hecht should be on every national newscast, should be on Fox News, on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, on the BBC, all the time. But what do we get? Trump 24/7. Why? Because he's Mr. Conflict. That's all he wants. And that's what it does tap into, a lower level of human nature, which is to focus on the negative, focus on the salacious. But you can make a choice, ladies and gentlemen, to flow with the tide. Things are actually getting better. There are less people dying per capita via warfare than at any time in human history, right now. How is that possible? We can kill each other so well, so efficiently, and yet less people are dying. Why? Because things are getting better. We have equal rights for women, equal rights for people of color, equal rights for gay and lesbian and transgender and bisexual and all the letters, LGBTQ.
We have penicillin.
We have penicillin. I'm sure you're very glad about that. So it's a wonderful thing to be part of this, and you can choose to be part of it. Just, I mean, the website, I just lost it, Stephen, is
millionpeacemakers.org.
Millionpeacemakers.org. Buy the book, Nonflict, The Art of Everyday Peacemaking.
It's amazing how you were telling those two the stories about those two gentlemen and how much they really had in common. And it's amazing too, hearing, you know, the archetype of the Midwest farmer who is a patriot and eventually gets drafted and goes into the military, who's and to fight an Afghani farmer who, you know, goes into, you know, fight the same cause, because both of them are trying to justify their, you know, potentially, you know, lost loved ones and to do something of value to their country for their people. And when they would have had so much in common, they end up shooting at each other, you know. So it's amazing how powerful starting with the commonalities is in your process.
You know, one thing we've talked about, Stephen, which kind of blows Owens and my mind from time to time, is we understand the historic influence of religion on conflict on the planet. And the understanding from the Mashiach, the anointed, the Messiah, the Jewish tradition is still waiting on the Messiah. Christian tradition is waiting on the return of the Messiah. Both missed it. The Messiah, the anointed one, by the way, his name wasn't Jesus, it was Joshua. They got it wrong right from the get-go. His name in Hebrew is Yeshua. It means salvation. He saved the planet. From what? From divisiveness. It was very clear. His message was, my kingdom is not of this world. The Jewish people and the Christian people are waiting for a military leader. He's not. That's not going to happen, folks. This is the understanding. The one guy who understood this in the New Testament writings was a guy named Saul, Jewish guy, who becomes Paul. He understood 2,000 years ago, he's the one that said, there's neither Jew nor Gentile anymore. There's neither male nor female anymore. There's neither bond or free. Even slaves and slave owners are equal, according to this understanding. This is very powerful. So Owen and I's, our brains get blown once in a while when, instead of the other disciples, which were James, John, Peter, their philosophy of divisiveness, that actually won the day 2,000 years ago. Then here comes Constantine. He co-opts this new thing called the Way. Eventually, the Roman Catholic Church happens. But we've talked about this, and this is actually happening. It's just taken a lot longer than it could have. The thing that blows our minds is, what if Paul's philosophy would have won the day back then? It's winning the day now. That's the tide that's flowing. But what if in the last 2,000 years, instead of divisive religion, divisive borders, men still lording their authority and their strength over women, etc., 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 what would the world look like if Paul's perspective and the perspective that I'm articulating right now would have won the day? Stephen, I don't think there'd be countries anymore. I just think we'd be one big, happy, beautiful family. You know, Donald Trump says all the time, well, without borders, there's no countries. There's no country. Yeah, right. There's not. Good. Let's work together. That's what I say. Let's figure it
imagine,
out.
Yeah, imagine if instead of winners and losers, we were all winners.
Yes. Why not? You know, John Lennon really was onto something. Imagine there's no countries. Imagine no heaven or hell. Guess what we've discovered? There's no heaven or hell. That's in the scriptures, by the way. There's no heaven or hell in the scriptures. Not in our understanding today. John Lennon knew what he was talking. Imagine no religion. There'd be no wars. You know, religion actually means something. It's from a Latin root word called religare. And it means to put back under bondage. Not to put under bondage, to return, to re-legion. Conceptually, spiritually, beautiful humans, we're free. Free to do what? Free to accept our true identity. Free to make a major, wonderful difference in the earth like Stephen Hecht is doing. Free, you're free. Free from the constraints of religious dictates and dogma and divisiveness and hatred, century-old hatred. You're free from that. But religion wants to put us back to what was done away with thousands of years ago in Jerusalem. For everybody, regardless of your faith, regardless of your national origin. I love America. I love Canada. I love Palestine. I love Israel. Why? Because I'm there. I love Florida because I'm here. I love Owen because he's me and I'm him. I love Stephen. This isn't that hard to get, beautiful humans. This is actually in your heart. I know you feel this right now, emotionally. This is what Paul said that was the renewing of the mind. This is what he said is salvation. Christianity says salvation when you pray a prayer. Bull crap. Salvation is where we need it between the ears. We were already cleansed. That's a done deal. You're as perfect as Christ himself, for Christ's sake. Get this. It will dramatically impact your life if you don't think that there's any separation between you and God and anybody else. Then you can step in to who you are, which is a peacemaker.
And we're not here to try and make converts and gather a new religion. It's just something to play with. It's just something that to try on and see how it feels, because this true understanding has been so powerful and universal.
Oh, I'm here to convert people. I'm here not for a salvation
the way that Christianity needs to.
No, religion needs to go, as Ronald Reagan referred to the USSR, on the ash heap of history. And it's going. It's happening. We're seeing it right now. And I'm sure, Stephen, when you will go meet the Pope next month, you'll bring this message to him.
So it's interesting you talk about freedom. We trained a advertising agency and marketing company. I did a workshop with them, and then they asked how they could help us in return. And I said, well, you could help with our strategy. And we did a few sessions with them, and we looked for the kind of person that would want to say, I must support Million Peacemakers, be it as a volunteer, a board member, or someone to actually adopt it, to use it. And we found two entry points, two types of people that would say, I must support Million Peacemakers. And the first type of person was someone seeking freedom. Freedom to be your best, freedom to get out from the burden of conflict, freedom to live life as you're meant to live it. And once those people get involved and use non-conflict, they would have major change or transformation, which would lead to survival of themselves, their family, their community, and ultimately survival of the species. We have enough people doing it. And that's a meme that would go around and around. The more survival, the more major change and transformation they would have. The other type of people that would get involved were people that see this as a gift to the world, like I did when I met the Palestinians. And once they use it in their lives, they see more unity, which leads to more harmony, more harmony, more unity. So when you said I sound kind of peaceful, it's because I'm living that, and I have unity and harmony. As well, I was motivated by freedom, and I see major change and transformation. So you could be motivated by either freedom or gift to the world or both, and those are the type of people we're looking for, or organizations we're looking for to leverage to become peacemakers. So that's one reason, one of the ideas that came out of our strategy session was to meet with religious leaders that meet with young couples. So often a priest will meet a young couple about to get married or a couple to get married, And wouldn't it be cool if they gave them the tools to resolve conflict in their lives that they could then use for themselves and to be better role models for their children? Because children learn from their parents or the people that bring them up how to deal with conflict. So I had to be in London to meet with the chief rabbi, the past chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks of the UK on October the 16th. And I had an opening in my calendar to meet the Pope on October the 15th. So I just put in my calendar to meet the Pope to give him this idea. And I then went around asking people if they knew the Pope, and no one knew the Pope. So it was now, and I was really positive I would meet him, and I hadn't yet booked my trip to London. It was now the third week of September, and I had to meet him October the 15th. And I was at a cocktail party, and I saw someone who looked like a priest get a long robe and a cross around his neck. So I introduced myself, and I told him the idea. He ended up being the Bishop of Montreal, Bishop Thomas Dowd. And he liked the idea, and so I said, great, do you know if the Pope is available on October the 15th? I have an opening. And he said, I'm really sorry, the Pope is busy. There's a bishops' conference. All the bishops around the world are going to the Vatican for that, and the Pope would be busy with us. But I'll be going there, and I happen to know the cardinal in charge of peace and the cardinal in charge of families. And if you want, I could share them this idea. So I gave them each a personalized book to share. And I then booked my ticket to London because it looked like the Pope was busy. But I didn't stop asking. And I happened to get a haircut, and my barber is Italian. I said, Giovanni, you know the Pope? And Giovanni said, it's funny you ask. The person whose hair I cut right before yours showed me a picture of his son meeting the Pope. Maybe he could help. I said, okay. So he introduced me to his son, who runs a organization that deals with anti-Semitism called ISGAP. And he teaches professors at Oxford every summer on anti-Semitism. They could then teach his classes. And he had attended a conference at the Vatican and met the Pope. And he liked the idea and asked if I could teach his professors that summer at Oxford in non-flict. And then he introduced me to the person running his Rome office, who maybe could help. So I spoke with Robert in Rome. And Robert said, your timing is really amazing because the Vatican is organizing this conference on religions and the UN Sustainable Development Goals. One of them is peace. And they're looking for mostly religious leaders, but also a few international organizations to present on how religions could make a difference toward these goals. Would you be interested in talking there? I said, sure. So that's what happened. So they agreed to have me talk. And the cardinal in charge of that event is one of the two cardinals who had my book, which really helped. So I'm meeting the Pope on Friday, March 8th, where I'll share our non-flick way and offer to help collaborate with them and other religious leaders on bringing non-flick to their communities. Because like it or not, about 8 in 10 people do affiliate with a religion. And so they're a nice, wouldn't it be cool if these religions taught non-flick?
Yes, and then they just could go away. That would be good. Just no divisiveness. You're doing it your way. We're doing it our way. And we all are flowing in the right direction. I mean, listen.
But your point of them working together at least is now what we're starting to talk about rather than fight each other, which historically had happened.
Exactly. And I know, I like this Pope. I mean, you know, he just seems pretty cool, but he's ahead of an organization that thinks that gay people are sinners. For example, he's ahead of an organization that thinks that using birth control is a sin. He's the head of an organization that does not allow women to have the same roles and rights in his organization as the men do. That's screwed up.
Yep.
That's effed up. It really is. And I mean, obviously, and I think in his heart of hearts, he knows it's wrong. Do you ever see the HBO show, The Young Pope with Jude Law?
I saw one or two episodes of it.
It was fan-freaking-tastic. He's the opposite of that kind of Pope. He's like a radical Pope, radical conservative Pope. And it's dark. It's very dark and sexy. And
Jude Law plays the Pope?
Yeah.
Interesting.
He's the young Pope. He gets in there like they think that they can manipulate him, the powers that be in the Vatican. And then they find out not so much. It's very interesting. I really enjoyed it. But it is, you know, just like.
So Glenn, your point is well taken. But you don't have, if we don't talk or try and make peace with people we don't agree with, then we'll never have peace.
No, I
don't have to agree with everything that the Palestinians said or that the Pope might believe in or that you might believe in to make peace with you.
I'll talk to them all day long. Of course, I'm at peace with them. I'm one. We are one. I'm one with Pope Francis. And so is everybody. But I'm one with the frickin' Nazis and the white supremacists. I'm not going to just say, oh, you know, it's so sweet what you guys are doing to the Jewish people or to African Americans or whatever. We're one with Trump. I don't like the way Trump approaches life, let alone his role as president. But that doesn't make me not one with him. And thank God that I had somebody, and it happened to be my cassette tape at the time, but just flat out tell me what the kind of religion that I was in as a Messianic Jew / charismatic Christian was just ridiculous, wasn't scriptural, was far from counterproductive, was destructive, was destroying people's lives, was causing people to be suicidal and to commit suicide. And I woke up, but it was like I had to be, I was like the donkey. Sometimes you got to hit a donkey between the eyes with a 2x4. And it woke me up. And sometimes, you know, it's a softer approach. The softer and gentler Stephen Hecht approach. He is the chief executive peacemaker of Million Peacemakers. The website is millionpeacemakers.org. And get the book. The book, Nonflict, The Art of Everyday Peacemaking, Mr. Pratt.
So if you were to have one takeaway for the listeners to be able to pick out of this session, this quality podcast,
this sesh,
how would you encourage them to take something from here and be able to see more peace manifest in their life?
I think if we just take the time to listen to each other with an open heart and open mind, that would go a long way of diffusing a lot of conflict. And again, you don't have to be agreeing with them to listen to them.
Exactly.
To do that.
In fact, it's easy to listen to people that you agree with, for God's sakes. I mean, the challenge is, the skill is to listen intently to people that you don't agree with. This tribalism that has occurred, is it as bad in Canada between the left and the right as it is down here?
It's not as bad. Our prime minister is more inclusive. And culture starts at the top in any organization, including any country. And so if you have divisive leaders, you'll often have it filtering down into society. So our current leader, Justin Trudeau, is more inclusive, and we're looking at embracing different people in order to have a stronger nation and taking advantage of the strengths we all bring and the assets we all bring to the table. So it's not quite as bad, but I live in Quebec, where we've gone up and down with identity politics, yes, as you would call it. And we're about to perhaps have some ugliness happen in our province with the current premier looking to ban visible religious artifacts, be it a cross or a kippah or a hijab, from people who are working in authority, such as judges or policemen or teachers. So we're about to have conflict in that way. We've had it before, and the last politician that tried bringing it into Quebec got booted out. Unfortunately, he just got elected, and they're going to try and make it into law, and there's going to be a lot of conflict here.
You talk about the Habib. One of the things that I like to do is when I see a young woman or a woman of any age with a Habib, but she's clearly a modern woman. She just has chosen to cover her hair that way. I always like to go and converse with them, because in our society, maybe not as much in Canada, there's a whole huge percentage of people that if they see a Muslim person that's obviously Muslim, and the women, it's more obvious, obviously, they don't look at them. They don't engage. They don't smile at them. I went to Target the other day, and I needed to find a mop, I think. I had no idea where the mop was. And there was this young woman with a little red Target shirt on, but with a Habib. And that's how you pronounce it, right, Stephen?
I think you mean hijab.
That's not how you pronounce it at all, Glenn. It's called a hijab. What's a habib? I don't. Who knows? The hijab.
I'm not sure.
So I'm glad I asked. So she had the hijab on, and so I made eye contact with her with a smile. Immediately, a smile came on her face, and I said, "Would you mind helping me?" She said, "Not at all." I said, "A, where are the mops? And which mop do you recommend?" And so she was so nice and pleasant. And then here came another coworker that saw her interacting with a, you know, middle-aged white male and in a pleasant way. And she said something nice. So you guys, that was peacemaking at work on purpose.
With a purpose.
Thank you. It's just one act. So, some are bigger acts, like when Steven decided to form this organization. But it's just one small, positive, bridge-building gesture, moment after another. That doesn't mean that you don't have your opinions. That doesn't mean that you can't have strong opinions. But what it does mean is that you realize that every single human being is precious and valuable and unique just the way they are. You know, it's not just a coincidence that we're called human beings. We're not called human doings. We're human beings. Be what? Be righteous. Be loving. You are love. Be what you are. Go to Stephen Hecht's millionpeacemakers.org. How can people participate, Stephen, in the upcoming weeks and months?
They could join our Facebook page. We have a Facebook page as well, Million Peacemakers. You could check it out. You could share any conflicts you have that we could maybe interact with you on. The book is an easy to read book. It's only 140 pages. And there are a lot of academic books out there. This had to be very practical and easy to apply right away. So if you are having serious conflict, I recommend you check that out. It's available on Amazon. And you could send me an email, drop me an email. There's contact information on the website. So if you want to get involved, introduce it to your family, to your community somehow, or your business, please get in touch with me.
And it's
my email address is shecht, S-H-E-C-H-T, at millionpeacemakers.org.
And Stephen Hecht is on Facebook, not just the Peacemakers. He's a friend of mine.
I'm a proud friend of yours. Proud to have you as a friend, Glenn. Back. And now Owen as well. Thank you.
Yes.
Back at you.
Building bridges.
Stephen Hecht. What a man. God, I'm proud of it. I'm going to live for Clem, Stephen. I'm just proud that life brought us together. Can't wait to meet you in person someday.
I look forward to it. Both of you, come on up.
Now, here's the big question. Are you a Montreal Canadiens fan?
I'm a Montreal Canadiens fan to some degree. I don't watch the hockey games too often. I watched the football game yesterday, which was interesting.
Owen didn't.
I slept through that whole thing.
Well, it was the worst football game that I've ever seen. I mean,
it wasn't that exciting.
Yeah, but
it's interesting. We're gonna have to get off in a minute. We could talk about it later. But our culture is made up, and we grow up with winners and losers.
Yes.
Sports. You win or you lose.
Yes.
There are no ties anymore, right? They play tiebreakers. So think about it. We're fighting against our upbringing here. I mean, when Trump is talking about winning and losing, that's what we're all
exactly
right up to feel.
Well, that's what we were talking about before. If Paul's philosophy would have won the day versus Roman Catholicism, basically, there'd be no more competitive sports. They'd all be cooperative sports. There'd be exercise.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, just we would be cooperating, having fun.
Yeah.
That would be
Can
good.
You imagine? Yeah, it would be great.
Can you imagine all the people? Thank you, Stephen. We love you.
Thank you, Glenn. Thank you, Owen. Great meeting you both.
We'll talk
great
to you soon.
Re-meeting you, Glenn, yes. And meeting you, Owen.
Yes. All right, there he goes. The great Stephen Hecht.
Wow.
I think he had another appointment.
That's pretty amazing.
Or maybe he didn't want me to hear me sing anymore.
I see here that he's also on Twitter and Instagram, Million Peacemakers. Small doses of just peace and non-flicked advice along the way. Optimism is the faith that leads to achievement. Helen Keller quote, Abraham Lincoln, folks are usually about as happy as they make their minds up to be. just some of his Instagram posts.
Living for the world. What is it? Ooh, 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 ooh. You got to start singing. You're the singer. And my voice is all screwed up to begin with anyway. Week four. Da, 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 da.
You're in it. You need to rest that
of
thing.
Name of my sex tape. We are so blessed to have you people listening, and we are here for you in any way we can serve. You can reach us at coachglennkline.com, or the podcast website is glennklineonline.com. And of course, so we have our very speedily growing show on sex and religion called sexinthepews.com. You should check that out. It's not for the faint of heart, and it's definitely not for shearing at work. But we get into this whole religious discussion a lot, and how it is impacted in not a very positive way. Religion has the expression of human sexuality. And you talk about violence against women. Hmm. Where do you think that all came from? Misinterpretation of that the women are, quote, the weaker sex, or should submit to the men. That is a misunderstanding religiously, and has done great damage. So we encourage people to check that out, too.
And one quick thing I've just found via Million Peacemakers Twitter is an interesting graph, and it shows different advances in technology and the time it took them to reach 50 million users. So the telephone took 75 years to reach 50 million users, automobiles 62 years, credit cards 28 years, ATMs 18 years, computers took 14 years, the internet took 7 years to reach 50 million users, Facebook took 4 years to reach 50 million users, and Pokemon Go took 19 days to reach 50 million users.
What's Pokemon Go?
It was a augmented reality app where you could hold up your phone and it would show you like a picture, the camera, you would see the real world, but there would be a Pokemon on your screen. So you hold it up to the couch and you see a little, you know, animated Pokemon creature dancing on your couch. You throw a Pokeball at it, you could catch it. It was a big phenomena a couple of years ago.
How long did it take?
19 days.
Wow.
And that's why we're doing the podcast, ladies and gentlemen. This is the whole point of Glenn Klein Online and Sex in the Pews, our other podcast. The intention of being able to reach millions of people and create positive cultural global change with this message of oneness and unity and freedom provided for everybody at no cost of belief, prayer, confession, etc.
It's organized fun with a purpose.
With a purpose.
On purpose. Thank you, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks again to Stephen Heck. Thank you for listening, and we will do it next time on Glenn Klein Online. Until that time, this is Glenn Klein.
And Owen Pratt.
Saying, Shalom, everybody.